Up to now, we focused on the origins of the racial wealth gap, how Black people have been consistently excluded from building wealth and ensuring their own financial stability since the end of slavery. Today, we're going to look at one of the first attempts to address the disparities, to make America a more equal society, to level the playing field. We're talking about affirmative action in education. This starts more or less in September 1965, with an executive order that makes new rules for federal contractors. It's not enough to not discriminate. That's already illegal. The order says it's time to ensure no one's being left out. President Lyndon Johnson was clear about his rationale. Here he is speaking at graduation at Howard University, the historically Black college in Washington, D.C.
You do not take a person who for years has been hobbled by chains and liberate him, bringing up to the starting line of a race, and then say you are free to compete with all the others, and still justly believe that you have been completely fair.
That's the theory behind affirmative action. It was the idea that it took work to unlock opportunity in a more equitable way. Black people in particular were entitled to additional consideration. This did two big things. One, it set aside government contracts to minority-owned businesses. It also radically changed college admissions. Colleges and universities tweaked their admissions policies to enroll more African Americans and other minorities. 5 years after Johnson signs that executive order, roughly 80% of colleges and universities have some kind of affirmative action in place. And Black student enrollment was going up. So in that regard, it's working. But it's not universally popular.
Far too many affirmative action programs divide rather than unite. Our children and grandchildren feel no responsibility for the conduct of their ancestors and the mistakes of America's past, and that is as it should be.
In 1998, a Black California businessman named Ward Connerly waged war on affirmative action in his state. Connerly was also a regent in the University of California system, and he was the driving force behind Proposition 209, a 1996 California ballot initiative to end affirmative action in the state. That's not what the text of the ballot initiative said, though. In fact, it didn't even mention affirmative action by name. It instead framed it as anti-discrimination.
Section 31A. The state shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in the operation of public employment, public education, or public contracting.
The preferential treatment it refers to, that's what would be the death knell for affirmative action. Connerly acknowledged that those kinds of measures had been necessary, but he argued it wasn't anymore. It had gone from being a transitional remedy to an entitlement, a crutch that had outlived its usefulness.
For Black people and our reliance on affirmative action, the time has indeed come to let go. We cannot forever look through the rearview mirror at America's mistakes. We must look through the windshield at its opportunities.
It was a radical position for a Black man to take. Civil rights groups roundly opposed the measure. Connerly said he was called an Uncle Tom, a lackey, and a sellout. But he won. Prop 209 passed with 55% of the vote, including, Connerly would later brag, 24% of the Black vote. By the late 1990s, affirmative action in California public universities was dead.
California's is the premier laboratory for testing this experiment. If this experiment works in California, my friends, it works anywhere. If it fails in California, its failure can be predicted throughout the land.
The United States was about to find out whether, as Connerly said, the experiment worked.
The data shows that the median white family has 10 times more wealth than the average Black family.
One of the drivers of that wealth gap is redlining. When it comes to understanding financial inequality in this country, economists often point to the absence of African-American generational wealth.
See, the black man gotta fly to get something that the white man can walk to.
From California tonight, a picture of how the nation's largest university system may be transformed now that its affirmative action program is going to be ended.
It's a trend propelled not just by economic forces, but by white racism and local white political and economic power.
It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee an annual income, for instance, to get rid of poverty.
Welcome back to The Paycheck. I'm Jackie Simmons.
And I'm Rebecca Greenfield.
The difference economically between having a college degree and not having one is huge. For full-time, year-round workers in their mid-20s and 30s, having at least a bachelor's degree is worth an extra $23,000 a year in income.
Even taking student debt into account, more education predicts higher incomes and more wealth at every level. For one, it opens up more better-paying job opportunities. College graduates make more money than people with a high school degree or even just some college. People with a graduate degree make more money than college grads.
It's not just jobs. People with a college or advanced degree are more likely to get benefits, like health insurance through their work, which adds an extra layer of financial security. Experts also believe more education leads to better financial decision-making. So people are making more money, and they're making better choices with it. There's another reason Black families seek out a college education.
My father was very keenly aware of the difficulty of just simply being Black. He never had an opportunity to learn to read, to write, to do those things that would make him competitive, at least to fight back. He would fight back, but you know, you could always be dismissed because you couldn't do something or whatever it was. So he always taught us it was important to get an education.
That's Shirley Weber. She's had a long career in California higher education and politics. In January, she was sworn in as a Secretary of State. She's a huge defender of affirmative action and says it was critical to her success at every point in her academic career.
Without that extra step, you know, I may would have done okay in life, but I doubt if I would have gotten a PhD by the time I was 26. And I doubt if I would have been a professor at the age of 23. I would have been struggling trying to figure out what I was going to do and how I was going to do it. That extra opportunity helped to get me to a level that I could actually excel, you know, demonstrate that I could do those things despite the fact coming from a very poor background. So my first contact with affirmative action was really myself.
Many Black professionals probably benefited from some kind of affirmative action. I might have too. I graduated in the late 80s and applied to a million schools, including some in California, and was told race might be one factor that could help me get a second look. I can't definitively say it worked or not, but fast forward 30 years, I've definitely had my share of professional success. Kelsey Butler is a reporter at Bloomberg. She applied to college about 15 years after I did. Hey, Kelsey.
Hi, Jackie.
So, if I understand, you weren't very comfortable thinking of yourself as having benefited from affirmative action. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's complicated because, you know, when I applied to college in 2005, being Black and Latina, it might have been something that got me a second look or even got me in the door with admissions officers. I honestly have no idea. But I feel like since then, in a lot of majority white spaces, you know, the term affirmative action hire or you're here because of affirmative action has been almost used as like a jab against me. And it kind of sours you almost on the concept. I spent a lot of time while reporting this, listening to all the arguments against affirmative action. Lots of tape, lots of recordings. I thought a lot about the racist roots of a lot of the arguments against affirmative action. And also kind of made me think about, well, if it didn't exist, then what really is there? You know, the doors to a lot of institutions would be closed to a lot of people. And is my discomfort at, you know, someone saying something ignorant? It seems really small when you think about it that way.
One of the problems with affirmative action is it gives certain people a leg up, maybe without them even knowing. And some people think that's unfair, even if it is creating a more level playing field. But what happens when that leg up goes away? Does it make things more fair? When California put a hard stop to affirmative action with Prop 209, it did do what Connerly said. It set up a huge experiment. The state had 3 decades of strong affirmative action measures, and then all of a sudden, it didn't. We asked Kelsey to find some answers about what that meant for Black wealth. So, Kelsey, where do we start?
Well, in terms of getting Black students to college, affirmative action definitely worked. In 1965, only 4.7% of African American adults had 4 or more years of college education, according to the US Census. It starts to go up pretty quickly after that, especially when you consider it typically takes at least 4 years to earn a bachelor's. By 1980, 8.4% of Black adults have a degree, almost double within 15 years. In another 15 years, so by 1995, a little more than 13% of Black adults have a 4-year degree or higher.
And that's before Prop 209, right?
Yeah, and actually in California, the numbers are slightly higher. By 1995, 17.5% of African Americans have a college degree or higher. Another way to put it is in about 30 years, the number of Black adults in California with a 4-year degree has gone from about 1 in 17 to better than 1 in 6. And this was after some of the earliest affirmative action measures had been watered down.
What do you mean by watered down?
Well, originally, some institutions used a straight quota system, setting aside a certain number of seats for Black and Hispanic students. Until 1977, and the U.S. Supreme Court case known as the Bakke case. Bakke was Alan Bakke, a white man and an aspiring doctor. He wanted to go to medical school at UC Davis in 1973. The school was new, and the student body was overwhelmingly white, so they decided to set aside seats for applicants they called disadvantaged, basically a euphemism for minorities. Bakke had good MCAT scores, and his interviewer described him as a well-qualified candidate, but he didn't get in. He complained about what he thought was reverse discrimination and was encouraged to apply again, and he was rejected a second time. So he sued, and his case made its way to the Supreme Court. 6 of the 9 justices wrote opinions in the case, and when you look at them, it's really clear how divided they are. Some of them said race-based quotas were clearly unconstitutional. Others said it was ridiculous to require schools to ignore race in admissions because of how Black people had been held back throughout U.S. history. In what was the controlling opinion, Justice Lewis Powell tried to bridge the divide. He said if there is a, quote, compelling state interest, race can be considered.
In my view, the only state interest that fairly may be viewed as compelling on this record is the interest of a university in a diverse student body.
The court didn't strike down all affirmative action. In fact, Powell quotes the admissions policy at Harvard as an example of a university that's doing it right. He even attached a copy of the policy to his opinion.
But UC Davis was doing it wrong?
Yeah, basically because they'd set aside these rigid quotas. There were 16 seats out of 100 that were essentially off limits to white people. But UC Davis can rethink its policy, which Powell practically begs them to do.
Yet the way is open to Davis to adopt the type of admissions program proved to be successful in so many of the universities and colleges of our country.
So within 10 years, basically, quotas are out. That's interesting because it seems like that's what most people think of when they think of affirmative action.
Yeah, that's a popular misconception. For most of its history, it's not that at all. At least in college admissions, it's much more flexible. Powell's decision does something else that's really important. He basically wipes out Lyndon Johnson's rationale for affirmative action. Undoing general racial discrimination or imbalance, that's not a compelling interest. The only justification he allows is the diversity argument.
So colleges are allowed to consider race?
Yes, but here's the difference. Where before colleges were allowed to have quotas, now they're allowed to consider race as one factor in pursuit of diversity in the student body. most colleges worked within these new parameters, adding race onto a bunch of other admissions criteria. It was no longer the only factor, or even the predominant one, but it was still very explicitly considered. At California public schools, for example, Black and Hispanic students had lower SAT score and GPA cutoffs for admissions. At places like Harvard, race is one factor of many that the school considers when letting students in. Black student enrollment drops for a bit, but then it continues to tick up. Even at UC Davis Medical School, the overall minority student admit rate is higher 5 years after Bakke than it was in the 5 years before. By 1996, the case against affirmative action has a new twist. There was the controversial idea of protecting white people from the threat of reverse discrimination. But now it's also about asserting that Black people no longer need a leg up or extra consideration of any kind. We've made it. That's the argument Connerly makes to support Prop 209. Its passage created an opportunity to find out whether he was right. Maybe we, Black people, didn't need affirmative action after all. Since Prop 209 took effect in the 90s, researchers have been looking at these questions. And enough time has passed that they think they have some answers. Zachary Bleemer is a PhD candidate in economics at the University of California, Berkeley. He looked at the impact of the law on Black and brown students.
We can compare the longer run outcomes of Black and Latino university applicants in the years just before 1998, when affirmative action was still in place, to the years just after 1998, when affirmative action had ended. We're just going to follow those cohorts of students along over the next 10, 15, or even 20 years and ask what happened to them as a result of their more selective university enrollment under affirmative action.
So that's what Bleemer did. He looked at where 10,000 college applicants in California ended up without Prop 209, both in college and in their careers. What he found was pretty clear.
Absent affirmative action, Black and Latino students are less likely to earn college degrees. They're less likely to earn graduate degrees, you know, following them another 5 years into the future. They're less likely to earn degrees in lucrative STEM fields. This is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, majors that are seen to provide long-run wealth returns to students.
Without those degrees, African Americans and Latinos made less money. After affirmative action ends, the average Black and Latino university applicant loses about 5% of their wages. Bleemer looked at higher earners, people making about $100,000 in California by their mid-30s.
So let's put that into context. California in 2014 had about 20,000 high-earning Black and Latino workers in the state around the ages of like 30 to 34. How would that number of workers change if affirmative action had stayed in place? And so those 30 to 34-year-olds had access to more selective universities 15 years ago when they went to college. And the answer is roughly 3 or 4%, so about 700 or 1,000 people working in California would have been high earning if they had access to these selective universities through affirmative action.
So for African Americans and Latinos, affirmative action had worked. They got more, better academic credentials, and that translated into higher salaries. But what about other students? One of the common arguments against affirmative action is that it takes one of those slots away from someone, quote, more deserving. Bleemer has looked at that too. If that argument was right, he theorized, then getting rid of affirmative action would make their outcomes better. It didn't.
Where did the white and Asian students who would have gone to Berkeley, where did they go instead? Most of them go to highly selective private universities of similar quality to UC Berkeley. And so as a result, when you follow those students along, providing them access to UC Berkeley actually gives them surprisingly little in terms of longer run wage outcomes.
That brings us back to the wealth gap. What Bleemer's research suggests is that part of the reason that affirmative action measures don't harm white and Asian students is because they tend to have other options. The reason they have those other options is because they are, on average, coming from families with greater wealth to begin with. Black and Hispanic students, on the other hand, don't have as many of those resources. That limits their options college-wise. They don't, again on average, have equal opportunities elsewhere. Right after Prop 209 passed, college enrollment for Black students in California state schools dropped by about 15%. Ever since, California legislators and advocates have been trying to overturn it or to find another way to strengthen affirmative action measures in the state. Colleges have continued to prioritize diversity, so overall, the number of Black people getting four-year degrees is still rising, but not as fast as it was. And it's never caught up to white people. Last year, as the pandemic swept across the U.S. and the Black Lives Matter movement put civil rights front and center, California lawmakers tried again. Shirley Weber led that fight. The ballot initiative, this time, was called Prop 16.
Okay, it was supposed to have been chaired by somebody else, of course, as usual, falls to me. And I just said, let's do it. You know, if we're going to do it, let's do it.
The language was clunky. It asked voters to repeal the amendment to the state constitution that prohibited discrimination or preferential treatment on the basis of race. But it had lots of support from across the left. The founders of BLM, the ACLU, and the California Teachers Union all lined up behind it. And lots of celebrities, too. Here's Ava DuVernay, Tracee Ellis Ross, and Issa Rae encouraging people to vote for Prop 16.
And the fight to dismantle systemic racism is on the ballot in California. Voting yes on Prop 16 is our chance to right the wrongs of the past.
Voting yes on Prop 16 is one way to prove that Black lives matter.
I'm voting yes on Prop 16 because I wouldn't have gotten into college had it not been for affirmative action, which means I wouldn't have had the same access to opportunities and resources as my white peers.
Voters in California, one of the most liberal states in the U.S., went to the polls again on affirmative action. It was a really big election, and the state's progressive voters were excited, either to boot out Donald Trump or to cast a vote for the first woman of color as vice president. Following a summer of Black Lives Matter protests, if there were ever a time for affirmative action to come back, this would be it. And Prop 16 lost. 57% of people voted against it. In nearly 25 years since California ended affirmative action, the policies had gotten even less popular. Shirley Weber thinks that Prop 16 made some people once again feel like they might be on the losing end of a deal.
If I tell you that, you know, we're looking at the universities, then, you know, there are only so many seats in the university. And will your kid get a seat? That's always a question. And so those who thought they had a certain advantage decided that it was too much to give, which is not uncommon. Too much to give. So, you know, it's one of the sad stories of the progressive California. Voting for affirmative action, equal opportunity and access was a little bit more than people wanted to do, you know, a little bit more. It may have cost them something.
So even if the advantage that white people might have overall is unfair to begin with or evolves out of centuries of unfairness, individuals don't see how that applies to them.
Yeah, and that perception of unfairness might be really hard to overcome. The thing is, focusing on education might be the wrong way to think about closing the racial wealth gap. For a long time, economists and policymakers thought that closing the education gap would eventually close the wealth gap. Better education, better jobs, more money, and voila, equality. But recently, a pair of economists at the St. Louis Federal Reserve suggested closing the education gap wouldn't even be enough. When you look at wealth across racial groups, so, for example, just among people with college degrees or advanced degrees, there are still huge gaps. The Fed research shows that white and Asian people, on average, basically benefit more from education than Black and Latino people do. At every level of education, the wealth gap and the income gap persists. What's at work, they say, are factors that you can't really see. Discrimination or other long-term structural disadvantages. They might account for as much as 72% of the wealth gap for Black families.
What do they recommend instead?
They don't really make recommendations, not in that paper. What they do say is that individual initiative or marginal policy changes might only chip away at the gap. To really make significant progress, we need, quote, more fundamental change in our society. Maybe we should stop fighting over small policy changes and push for bigger, more radical things. Shirley Weber is doing just that. In October, California passed into law another piece of legislation she wrote.
And we'll just start here by signing this.
With this signature, Governor Newsom made history, making California the first state in the country studying and developing proposals for potential reparations for African Americans.
That bill is focused on African Americans, not on equity and everybody else. You know, there's an awful lot owed to a group of people who've been here 400 years, came here before the Mayflower, and still are at the very bottom of opportunity. So whether it manifests itself in reparations, or whether it manifests itself in affirmative action remains to be seen.
So what does the bill say?
They're going to study reparations. It's a first step, and for people really interested in leveling the playing field, so to speak, it's an important one.
For much of the past 150 years, no one took the movement for reparations all that seriously. It's different now. There are tons of questions about what real reparations would look like in the U.S. Next week on The Paycheck, we find out what happened when one affluent Chicago suburb went looking for answers.
It is a way to repair egregious injury and crimes against humanity against the Black community. And we need to acknowledge that. And so, yes, it is reparations. Let's not call it anything else to make you feel better about it, your role in it, or our inability to address it before now. Let's call it what it is.
Thanks for listening to The Paycheck. If you like this show, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was hosted by me, Rebecca Greenfield.
And me, Jackie Simmons. Today's episode was edited by Janet Paskin and reported by Kelsey Butler.
This episode was produced by Lindsay Cradawill. We also had production help from Magnus Henriksen and editing help from Francesca Levy, Rakshita Saluja, Jackie Simmons, and me. Our original music is by Leo Sidran. Francesca Levy is Bloomberg's head of podcasts. We'll see you next time.